Hello, and welcome to Community Conversations. Community Conversations is a series of recorded interviews lasting 30 to 40 minutes and played here on KRFY 88.5 FM at 8 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. This interim show is a temporary alternative to the KRFY morning show. We will bring you topics of current interest, highlighting voices from our community. Please bear with us for any pauses or glitches caused by internet or Zoom connections. And finally, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that it is broadcast. This is Julie Calamine, your Community Conversation host, and our topic today is technology and wildlife. I'd like to introduce our guests today, and the first one is Dr. Sophie Gilbert, PhD, professor at the College of Natural Resources, University of Idaho, Moscow. Hello, Sophie.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And our second guest today is Mark Dittmer, PhD, formerly at Boise State and now postdoctoral research scholar at the University of Michigan. Hello, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, I just would like to start by saying that I feel honored to have you both with me today. You work on wildlife research for some of the most important species here in Idaho and for Mark now in Michigan. I'd like to start with a bit of background about both of you, and we'll start again with Sophie. Sophie, how did you become interested in wildlife research?
Yeah, so I grew up in rural Northern California with lots of wildlife right out the back door in the yard and was always really interested in them. I think career-wise, I actually was pretty sure that I wanted to go to med some time. So and went down the ecology track and eventually the large mammal track, which leads you to wildlife. And that was in grad school.
Okay. And you broke up during part of your explanation. You were just starting telling us that you were originally going to go to medical school and then change paths. So we missed a bit of that.
Okay. Well, I will try again. So for a while I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but I ended up kind of veering away from that when I realized that it would mean almost all my professional time was spent indoors. And so I started looking for an option that would let me spend some quality time outdoors as part of my work and came back to my love of wildlife for that.
Okay, and what degree program did that result in? And then tell us about the work you currently do.
Okay, I have an undergraduate degree from the University of California in Los Angeles in ecology and evolutionary biology, and a PhD from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And then I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Alberta and then got this job here 4 years ago. And I'm loving Idaho so far.
You've been all over the place. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And how would you describe your work today? What is that work?
I'm really focused on how animals, especially large mammals, respond to environmental change. And a really important topic now as our world is changing really rapidly. And part of that work also focuses on what we can do to ensure that populations of species that we care about will survive and thrive in the changing modern world.
That's a big area of research and lots to learn and lots to work on for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful. Let's now return to Mark, and I'm going to ask you the same questions, Mark. How did you become interested in wildlife research?
Well, I had quite the circuitous path. Grew up interested in these sorts of topics. Can still hum you the Marty Stauffer's Wild America theme song. But I actually went down a different route. When I went to undergrad, coming from a more lower middle class family, I saw it as a stepping stone to better career. So I got involved in econ and finance. Well, I quickly learned that it wasn't for me, and doing a lot of backpacking during college and afterwards re-sparked my love of ecology and nature, and started taking nighttime courses, and eventually leveraged my sort of statistical and modeling background to get into grad school, even without the sort of traditional background in ecology. And I just happened to fall into a project where I got to study what I was most interested in and how humans alter the landscape and influence where animals go and why they make decisions. And so I worked with American black bears in northwestern Minnesota, which is mostly an agricultural landscape, for my PhD.
Yes, a lot of sunflowers up there, aren't there?
Oh yeah, the bears love them.
Yes. So your results ended with a PhD in something.
It was technically in a conservation biology. And then I worked doing kind of postdoctoral work at the University of Minnesota and also with the Minnesota Zoo for a while, and then eventually transitioned to working at Boise State. And then the person I was working with actually transferred to University of Michigan, and that's where I currently am working.
I see. Well, you've been all over the map in terms of your education and also your geographical locations, much like Sophie. And what are you working on now?
Sure, yeah. My main area of focus is finding ways to incorporate what we call sensory pollutants, so artificial light and noise. And there's new ways that we're able to capture these changing environmental stimuli and link them to where animals are going and how they're behaving. And that's, I have a whole set of projects working on that. I'm also still continuing research in Minnesota using drones with thermal technology to count moose. And it's just kind of several ongoing projects like that.
That sounds very interesting, and hopefully we'll get to that to hear more about that. Well, you're both kind of coming to this topic from similar but slightly different backgrounds, more similar than different, but definitely doing different work, both for the good of large animals and our mammals and wildlife and understanding how we're changing their environments. But today's topic is one that Phil and I thought would be an interesting one in the time of COVID, because we're stuck indoors. Here we are, stuck indoors, and everyone's using technology for just about everything, as are we today using our Zoom. And we just started wondering, you know, how is the technology that's being used with wildlife research and just the technology in general, how is that affecting our wildlife? And we've seen a few articles out there, and so just thought it would be great to get two experts on wildlife biology to help us understand that better. So as I've mentioned, we've been using remote technology for a long time, and it's definitely increasing as our technology improves. I'm hoping that you might both tell us about the many, many ways researchers are using technology in research today. So Sophie, maybe you would start.
Sure, yeah. I think technology is a key component of a successful wildlife research program now, and there's almost no way to avoid using technology, and it's really allowed us to ask and answer really exciting in terms of the kinds of research that we do. I would think the big categories would be remote triggered game cameras, which a lot of folks are probably familiar with. They might use them for scouting, for hunting, or just for taking cool pictures of animals in their neck of the woods. We also use those for research. GPS tags and collars, or other geolocators that you can actually attach to an animal, and that will let us know where in space an animal is at different times. Those are obviously great for wide-ranging animals that migrate or use big landscapes. And then obviously drones is an area of emerging interest and usefulness in wildlife, but doesn't get as much use as those other two. I don't know, Mark, what do you think? What am I missing here?
I don't think you missed anything that would be a major category, but just sort of the ways that we're able to collect a lot, more information whenever we do, say, put a collar on an animal to understand where they're going. We can also collect a lot of different other biological samples that new technologies and new methodologies are allowing us to answer a lot of additional questions every time we take data from one animal. So it's just sort of grown in that aspect too. It's just endless possibilities to learn many different components of, say, an animal's diet, with also where it goes, just all from several different technologies whenever we do work with an individual.
Yeah, very good. So I'm going to just throw out two more, and these don't seem very high tech, but here in North Idaho, we have ongoing helicopter surveys. I mean, it's a form of remote technology, but certainly noticed by animals. And then the other one that they have been doing a lot of is what seems very simple, but then it ends up with a technological end, and that's the stringing of barbed wire to collect hair from animals migrating. And then I think they take DNA samples from the hair samples, right? That's my understanding anyway.
Yeah, I can start us off on that one. So I guess it broadly interpreting technology, if we want to talk about how we can use technology to learn from samples of animals through really innovative uses of genotyping, for example, DNA we can collect from the environment, that's a whole other realm of the use of technology. And there's some just awesome stuff going on. Everything from being able to tell exactly which animal left a piece of fur or a feather or scat, even getting DNA from the bottom of footprints left in the snow. All of those things are possible now. And then other really neat stuff, like being able to tell more about what kinds of foods an animal ate using genetic sequencing from the poop of an animal. There's all just amazing things we can do now.
I so agree. I'd like to hear what technologies each of you are using right now. Mark, you mentioned that you're using drone technology with heat sensors for the moose and the moose babies. Tell us about that and anything else you're currently using.
Sure. So the study was launched a few years ago because moose are no longer able to be handled by researchers in Minnesota because we had some abandonment issues where after they were handled, the mother moose would basically sometimes leave the calves, maybe because of the scent or because of the fear of the researchers. And so for a few years, we were sort of going blindly into understanding the calving situation, whether calves were surviving, how many calves were being born. And these are important things because moose aren't exactly doing very well in Minnesota and lots of areas at the southern edge of their range. And so we employed thermal video cameras on drones and flew them over where there was adult moose that still had GPS collars to see if we could count the calves that were alongside the adults in each spring. And it was a pretty cool study because the first season we did pretty terrible at it because we didn't know when to fly and where and how to do all the counting. And so we had 25% detection in that, or ability to actually see those calves. But then as we learned, we sort of learned what times of day do we get the best thermal contrast with the camera, where on the landscape can we see them best, so we didn't have to fly as often. We could just fly more at smarter times of day and earlier in the year, and we're able to get our detection success up to about 85%. So we really improved from one season to the next, and so now we're able to kind of understand how often are the adults having calves in a much more robust way than, just through other ground sighting methods. And a lot of other technology I've been using is just sort of the traditional GPS collars on individual animals, but I've been combining it with some new remotely sensed imagery. And these are satellite derived estimates of where there is artificial light at night, and to understand how gradients of light, so just say just outside of a city, versus wildlands where you have only just a few tiny, lights here and there. We're now able to, with NASA imagery, understand the intensity and where lighting is and how it changes through the season, say a ski resort and things like that. And we can use that imagery and link it with where animals are moving and how they're using the landscape. And I also think it's a great proxy for just where are people moving on the landscape to understand where that disturbance might be. So, and also just where there is even, say, effort from citizen scientists and sort of account for some of the, you know, inherent bias of people are going to see animals where they live and things like that. And by understanding where people are and where they live, we can actually build better models of wildlife to have better estimates of how many are there and what are they doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Must be interesting work. And I hope you're gathering useful data. It sounds like you are.
Yeah, it's been great. A lot of it has been in Southwest U.S. on with cougars and mule deer, but I'm also working on that citizen science effort with Minnesota black bears.
Very good. Sophie, let's get back to you and I'll ask you what types of remote technology you are using or have used. Okay, Sophie, maybe you're muted.
Oh, here we go.
Okay.
I was just going to say I've used most of the technologies that we touched on earlier. Some of the really that I rely on are GPS collars, just like Mark. Those are kind of the standard bread and butter way that we find out about animals in space. The downside of that, of course, is that to use that technology, you have to actually catch an animal, capture it, put your hands on it to attach that collar. The data you get back is just incredible. You know, these days, GPS collars can give you what we call a fix, a satellite location on your animal every 5 minutes for a big animal. But the downside is, of course, that we have to handle those animals. I also use camera traps quite a bit, which is nice because those are a lot less invasive. You don't actually have to ever touch an animal to learn a lot about those animals from a camera. And then I do still use drones for some of my current work. You know, and a project where all of those things intersect that I'm currently working on is looking how deer and elk use agricultural landscapes in Idaho. And if there are management interventions that we can do to actually change their behavior and keep them out of trouble. And so that's focusing on white-tailed deer and elk. And to do that, we have deer and elk with GPS collars attached to them. We look at some of the responses to the treatments we're using, not just the GPS collars, but also camera traps to capture images of animals responding to treatments. And then we also use drones to count animals in fields to, again, get another metric of how animals are responding to our treatments. Some of the things we've tried have included scent-based treatments where we actually drip predator urine in hopes of convincing the animals that it's a risky. We play them sound from speakers that are scheduled to play during certain times of day. We have also put up things like fences and monitored the efficacy of those fences using camera traps, all kinds of things where it's really critical that we have those technologies out to measure how well they work.
So that sounds like a potentially very useful application to save game animals in Idaho, because as I know very well, in northern Idaho, the predation permits for elk have been on the rise. So people are definitely bothered by elk getting into the wrong places, and deer, I suppose.
Looks like Mark has something to add there.
Yes.
Well, not about that. Sorry.
Well, that's all right. Go ahead, Mark.
I was just going to add, Sophie was mentioning about, you know, becoming less invasive, and that's true with a lot of the technologies that, you know, we at least aim to reduce the invasiveness, at least through time of, you know, there's always going to be some level of invasive handling if we're trying to put a GPS collar on an individual and things like that. And so for an example of another technology that I've used I didn't mention is I work with medical researchers to actually implant these tiny biologgers in some of our bears. And what they do is they're placed just under the skin. And these things have been dramatically reduced in size over the past 5 years. And now they're developed for humans, but they work in animals as well. And what these allow us to do is capture the animal's heart rate in a minute-to-minute averages. And then what I can do is link, where did the animal go with changes in its heart rate? And the heart rate it can signal a stressor response. So for example, I've been able to capture how bears respond to crossing roads, how their heart rates change as they move across a roadway, and does it depend on how much traffic a road has. And even really low drone flights, we found that bears had very strong stress responses when drones were flown at really low altitudes close to them. So things like that, you know, they're always going to maintain some level of invasiveness, but we're constantly working to reduce that and to also to gain, if we're going to have to handle an individual and cause some sort of invasive behavior, like get more data and more information from every individual that we do handle so that we don't have to handle as many.
That's really interesting. And, you know, it kind of brings us nicely to the next topic I wanted to discuss, which is what are some of the negatives of our remote technology, whether it's being used by you, careful scientists, or others. But as I might have mentioned in the beginning, Phil and I were chatting about what would be an interesting topic. And of course, drones is an interesting topic because we see them and they feel invasive to us. And I'm certain that they do to animals. And you've just explained that your biomarker can help you understand just how much they're bothered. But let's move on and just ask about or talk about your use of these remote technologies versus those of the general public. And like what, maybe if you could help me understand how much is being done by careful scientists as compared to how much is going on in the country or the world overall. So who would like to start on that one? And was I clear? Maybe not very clear. Just sort of, you know, talking about if we have any idea of the overall effect on wildlife of all these technologies.
Well, I would maybe start by saying that we're becoming more cognizant of, you know, even if we don't think a certain technology when it's being introduced into wildlands or around wildlife might not be, you know, what we would generally automatically assume is invasive in some capacity. But I think there's a new sort of push to understand how animals perceive their environments in terms of, you know, noise and light pollution, things like that. So you know, talking about like cell phone use in the backcountry and things like that. You might think, what's the big deal? Well, I mean, it brings in noise that may, you know, disturb wildlife, things like that. And in terms of, you know, scientists' use of these things, I think, you know, like, for example, my study where we scared the bears with the drones, the idea was to understand, had no idea how they might react. And one of the sort of interesting pieces of that is that most of the time the bears didn't go fleeing, running away, but they sort of just kind of sat there and freaked out.
Yeah.
as measured by their heart rates. And so, you know, you can't just, even as scientists, we don't necessarily know just by looking at an animal, are we causing harm or are we causing a stress response? And so, you know, I think with the drone issue, you know, and people's use of those, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, it's gone up and up and up with more and more people using them. And, you know, I think there are probably ways that you could responsibly use them, especially if you're able to get, you know, say a camera that can, you know, record at greater distances. But it's a hard thing to like give an exact value to say, fly at this height and you should be fine. Each animal's going to be different. Depends on the environment, on all sorts of different conditions. And so it's really difficult. So I just usually tell people like, it's probably not a good idea to get them anywhere near wildlife, for example. In terms of the other technologies, you know, that's, you know, maybe Sophie can add something there, but just certainly thinking about drones is always the big question that I get asked over and over again because of, you know, a couple of my studies.
For sure. It's the one I'm most interested in too. Sophie, would you like to add to this topic?
Sure. Yeah. Well, just piggybacking on what Mark was saying about drones, you know, one of the huge kind of looming conservation concerns, we do know, as Mark said, that it can disrupt animal behavior and then induce these hidden stress responses like increases in heart rate and stress hormones. And in the future, we expect a big surge, not just in hobbyist use, So what you or I or the average citizen would be doing recreationally, but also in commercial drone use for deliveries, for example, and kind of what the consequences of that aerial disruption and habitat fragmentation, really what those consequences will be, we really don't know. And right now that use is regulated by the FAA. And honestly, I don't think they have any wildlife biologists on staff. So they are not really thinking that way in terms of regulating that growth, especially that commercial growth. In terms of other technologies and how they disrupt wildlife, I'm not too worried about camera traps. I think that's actually a pretty fun and harmless way to learn more about wildlife. I would just say that the only caveat I might have for any hobbyists out there is if you're using a flash to try to get really high quality night photos, do just be careful with that. Let's say you were lucky enough to find a kill site or a den site or a watering hole or congregate, and you're trying to camera trap it because you want to learn more about them and get that really neat photo. Just be careful with trying not to disturb the animals when you do that with things like a flash. And of course, don't put out bait or attractants to try to get that perfect photo, right? So we're trying to not change the animal's behavior when we do this stuff.
Yeah, really good points. Mark was just talking about the noise. We were both talking about the noise of drones and how we don't understand how that will affect wildlife or perhaps fragment their habitat. It brought to mind an interesting report I heard the other day about communication of humpback whales. Maybe you've both seen or read about that. During the time of the pandemic, of course, we've seen a reduction in traffic on the ocean, and it's changed the way the whales are communicating. Sort of like a shout versus a conversation. They've been able to tone it down and have more complex whale conversations. So an interesting opportunity to understand the effect of boat noise on whales.
For sure. We're just learning scratching the surface with understanding how noise influences wildlife in a lot of different ways, between causing stress to, missing mating opportunities, things like that. There's now a lot of before a lot of it was done in the lab, but we've seen a lot of really cool experiments in past years of with, I think Sophie was mentioning, the speakers in the field and things like that, a lot of actual in-field experiments that have really extended that. And now we're actually with the National Park Service has a bunch of recording stations, 400 and some throughout the country, where they're able to collect noise continuously. And then from that, they've been able to build out models to understand how much anthropogenic noise is sort of happening around the country on average. And a lot of people are doing some really interesting work with that.
I bet it's going up. I imagine that noise is going up and up. Right. I would like to ask you both if you have any anecdotal information, any little stories. Mark, you've shared your stories about freaking out the black bears, poor little things, but all for the good of science. And Sophie, I know you're probably tired of relaying this story, but you were quoted in the Spokane Spokesman and also in another source, which I'm not remembering right now, about a very popular video that went out on the internet of a bear mama and her baby trying to scale a very steep cliff in snow. And you had some comments that I think are worth repeating, if you don't mind, one more time.
Yeah, you bet. I will never get tired of repeating this. So the video, for those who haven't seen it, basically involves a mama bear walking along the edge of a really steep snowy slope with her cub, and the cub slides down this incredibly steep slope, hundreds of feet, and then climbs back up. And right as it's getting to the top and is about to rejoin mom, it falls down again because mom actually kind of lunges at the cub a little bit and kind of looks like maybe even pushes it down the hill. And, this was circulating on the internet, making the rounds on Twitter and Facebook and the rest of it with kind of captions about, when you're down, just keep going, you know, always get back up again. Persistence pays off, you know, inspiring stuff like that. And the reality was that that footage was taken from a drone, and the drone very much appears to have gotten quite close to the mama bear and her cub. And you can see her looking right into the camera as it's zooming towards them. And potentially her even responding defensively with a paw swipe to push her cub away from the very unknown danger. And we know that footage is from Russia. We don't know a lot more about it. You can see the shadow of the drone on the snow. So we do know that, that at least that much is true. But I think more broadly that the take home lesson is that if certainly if you see an animal responding, looking at it, changing its body posture, moving away from it or moving towards it, you know that you're far too close with your drone. You've gotten too close. And as Mark does not seem to be responding, you might still be too close. They might still have an elevated heart rate or some other kind of stress response. So just really keep back, give animals their distance, and be especially careful of animals that are, you know, reproducing, have young with them, are nesting, are migrating, you know, any of these kind of key moments in an animal's life, we want to make sure to give them plenty of space. Because you might think it might not matter when one person does it, but think how many people are out there, you know, trying to have a good time with their drones and maybe not thinking about what those cumulative effects of all those different people are.
Yes, Mark, would you like to add anything, any additional stories or ideas?
The only thing I could say is that, you know, the bear study was early on, and, you know, we wanted to fly at pretty low altitudes, understand. So if a hobbyist was just out trying to get a really good shot of an animal, how might they respond, whether it's behaviorally or a stress response? And based on that, we then, you know, when I embarked on this moose study, I don't want to seem like a total hypocrite, we then flew those drones at the highest altitude that we're allowed to under the FAA. And we did a couple preliminary tests and, you know, didn't seem to have any sort of response, but that was several hundred feet up. And so that's not going to, you know, provide some, you know, beautiful picture of moose and things like that. But it's, you know, just something to be cognizant of, you know, altitude is really going to have a big influence on the animal, because it's the noise that they're responding to, not the sight of the drone most likely. So if you're flying a fixed wing, obviously, you know, the higher the better for less disturbance to wildlife if you're going to be around them at all.
And Sophie, you've got another comment. Oh, I think you're muted, Sophie.
I was just going to say some of these technologies can also help us solve wildlife problems. So just a quick anecdote from one of our recent projects, we actually used playbacks of white noise coupled with these scent dispensers that dispensed cougar urine to keep white-tailed deer out of crops. And that white noise basically blocks their ability to hear a predator approaching is what we were thinking, hypothesizing. And it makes them uncomfortable to be kind of going without that key sense. And so they actually are avoiding that spot on the landscape, which maybe means that we don't always have to build physical fences if we can keep animals out of trouble in key spots on the landscape using other ways of modifying their behavior. In this case, a sound fence or a sound barrier. So it's not always bad. Sound does affect animals, but we can also use that to keep them out of conflict.
Yeah, a really good point. And so while they may be avoiding areas that would be fine for them to be in based on white noise, we, as you're saying, it may become a really positive aid in keeping animals from harm, maybe even on highways in the future, something like that. So it could be a useful technique. I have one story to share, and I'm going to share it because I think many Sandpointians, many folks here in Bonner County have heard a little bit about this story. But we have just a wonderful osprey family that lives over our on a light above our memorial field where our annual music festival normally takes place and our football games in the fall. And we have one family that's been there for a long time and another one that was a new family on another post. And there was a tragedy in that the younger family of ospreys were raising their babies and were being watched over by a drone, buzzing them. And ospreys, I think everybody knows, get pretty protective of their nests. And in this case, they both got very excited, were flying around trying to scare away the drone, and they collided in midair and both died. So that is a very tragic instance of a drone making a really negative difference. And it was a recreational drone, not a research drone. So folks, we need to be careful with the drones, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yes, I think so. Well, we've covered a lot of what we wanted to talk about, but I'm wondering from both of you if you have any ideas. You've offered great do's and don'ts about using remote technologies, but wondering if you have any recommendations for what one of our listeners might do if they notice technology being used in a way that they feel is really harmful to wildlife. Who do you call? Not Ghostbusters.
Yeah, just like when you see other things that are infringing on wildlife, I would recommend calling state wildlife law enforcement. So call the wildlife troopers. You can look that up on Idaho Fish and Game's website, what that number is. Just like if you saw someone poaching, same number to call. That'd be my recommendation.
Makes sense. Mark, anything else, or would you agree with that?
I'd agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, seems like the right way to go. And then also wondering if you, first of all, do you feel like I've missed anything? Is there a topic that you'd like to add that we haven't covered from either?
Yeah, just one other interpretation of the topic of technology and how it intersects with wildlife that I'd thought of was, you know, we live in the era, especially now that we're doing everything remotely, we don't see each other so much, of social media. And, you know, it's really nice to get those likes and that interaction, whether it's on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, you know, and often really shots and photos and videos of animals that are really up close and personal, maybe a selfie with an animal, those can garner a lot of interaction on social media and can feel really good. But often getting those shots is really dangerous, both for the people and for the animals. You know, every year people get trampled by bison and elk in Yellowstone, trying to get too close, trying to get that shot. That's a great way to get attacked by a defensive mama bear. Even mom deer and elk will attack you if you get too close to their babies. So just really, no matter how much you want that close-up wildlife shot for your social media, just be really careful and respectful of those animals. It's not worth it for you or.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. Any last thoughts on this topic, Mark?
Yeah, that's a great reminder. You see, you know, I mean, I don't encourage it because it just provides more views, but I mean, you can go on YouTube or whatever and see, you know, improper use of drones around wildlife, and you don't need to be a scientist to realize that you're causing harm. it's as Sophie mentioned, it's not worth it, and you're just ruining it for everyone that does want to, you know, potentially use technology in a more respectful way.
For sure. Well, we definitely know where to go to see how not to get close to wildlife with your remote technology. But do you know of any resources for the lay people, for us who might like to learn more about using technology safely with wildlife?
There's been some papers published that kind of give, you know, some key bullet pointed guidelines for safely interacting with wildlife. And I do believe those, some of those are available to the public. I know there was one in conservation biology that got, and it also got a lot of coverage in the media. So those bullet points made it out. I'd be happy to look that up and share it with you so you can share it with your listeners.
That'd be great. And as we come to a close, you guys are busy researching, so I'm sure you don't want emails all the time, but is there a contact either at the U of I or U of Michigan that would be helpful for folks if they had specific questions, or would they be best just to work on that locally? I'm just not sure what's the best contact for folks looking for more info.
Sure, yeah. I'm happy to share my email. SophieGilbert@uidaho.edu. But even better, I think, would actually be come find me on Twitter. I participate in wildlife Twitter. My handle is Sophie L. Gilbert. And I love answering people's wildlife questions on there, in part because when you ask a question, probably 1,000 other people have that same question and would love to hear the answer. And so that's a really nice way where if you do come ask me a question there, I can then answer and a lot of other people can get that answer at the same time.
I think that's great, Sophie. I appreciate that. And I'll be going there myself because I'm sure I'll have some wildlife questions. Any other ideas, Mark?
Yeah, actually, I was going to mention that, you know, there's no dumb question. You can just shout out to, you know, the wildlife Twitter and people will definitely respond. And I've seen a lot of great interactions from, you know, the public coming and asking questions about all sorts of things. And this is certainly a great area that you could get a quick response about. You know, we might not know certainly everything, but can at least provide you with the distilled down most, you know, relevant science as to, you know, what might be appropriate or not. And yeah, I can be reached on Twitter at M. Dittmer, D-I-T-M-E-R. If you want to do that.
That's great. Well, I think that's great advice from both of you because it's an easy way to get a question answered. And a lot of this is new territory for all of us, technology and our drones, et cetera. Well, with that, I'm going to conclude our community conversations for today. This has been Julie Calamine, your morning show host, bringing you the topic of technology and wildlife with our guest today, Sophie Gilbert, PhD, from University of Idaho, College of Natural Resources, and Mark Dittmer, postdoctoral research scholar at the University of Michigan. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks for having us. We really appreciate you engaging with this topic and sharing information with folks.
Very good. Thanks, everybody. We'll be in touch next week.